taping today is November 8th. We're learning Hosea Amos. This is our last class before the midterm on Thursday. And our purpose today is to explain how Hosea closes his book and to sort of tie things together over what he had been predicting until now. That is an overview of what we'll do right now from Perek Yud-Bet, Yud-Gimel, and Yud-Dalet. And while we do this, we will have our attention on two things. One, why does the Haftorah of Shabbos Shuvah come from this section of Hosea? As well as the Haftorah of Parshas Vayetze. Okay. First question is second question will be obvious very shortly. So the Torah of Vayetze will present itself immediately, the Torah of Shabbos Shuvah is going to be a little more of a curiosity. All the Nevi'im speak about doing tshuva. If the point of Shabbos Shuvah is to turn us down the straight and narrow, every Navi of Treyasar could have been chosen, Sheol Yuvi of Yechesel could have been chosen. I may not choose from Yehoshua Shokim Shmuel Malachim, because that's narrative, but any Navi of Nevi'im Achronim could be chosen for that. Right? So what is special about Hosea that's such an important tshuva at the case? And then there's another goal we have in this short time we have together this morning, which is, as I started saying before, to wrap up the historical background of this time period. The very first day of this semester, we discussed what's going on in Aram, in Ashur, and between the northern and southern kingdoms. Hosea is the first person, historically, whose spirit rose within him to complain publicly about what's going on in Israel. The Nevi'im before Hosea basically appear in the biblical text only when a king does something wrong. Right? Or something grand, like what Eliyahu does in Yom Kippur, the priests of Baal, the power of karma. Prophets don't put up crates in the subway station or in a public square exhorting the masses to better behavior. Hosea is the first person to do that. And there's Amos, and there's Yeshayahu, and there's Micha, and many others follow. Right? So the reason for this is because there may be a natural correlation for a nation to feel, if I am successful, this means my God is happy with what I'm doing. Right? If I am suffering, this means that I'm doing something wrong with my God. It's certainly standard fare in the ancient world, right? I just said today's, if anyone says Tehillim by the day of the month, today's Tehillim, Perek Mem Aleph, David says, God, make me successful against my enemies, then I will know that I find favor in your eyes. There's a bit of a fallacy in that. Right? Does this mean that every time some misfortune comes to us, that means that God is dissatisfied with what I'm doing, really? Is that true about you? Is it true about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov dealing with their infertility? Is it everything that's bad that happens to us? Really, you want such a black and white explanation of what happens to us? There's no nuance in your philosophical idea of how God behaves with us? Right? But, okay, we'll excuse B'nai Yisrael not being nuanced in their philosophical notions about how God relates to them. The fact is that in the time of Hosea, we were phenomenally successful in the world. Our borders extended north into Asia Minor, way east, and way south. Right? These kings ruling at the time of Hosea, you know, could be forgiven for thinking that God is okay with what we're doing. Right? You got me? Now Hosea begins his book by saying, remember the three issues in the beginning in Sefer Melachim. You've got Bamos, which is a perfectly legal situation at some times in our history. We discussed this at quite a bit of length last week. Bamos, the object of the worship of Bamos is God. It's done according to 100% according to halacha. It's just that it's not in the right place. You're offering a korban in your backyard, like a regular Pesach korban toldah, korban chatos. It's just not in the place where it should be. Right? The object of your sacrifice is the God who took us out of Egypt. That's one. Two, Egel worship. The two calves and done in Beit El. Who's the object of that worship? Also God. When they set up these calves, they said these are the gods who took you out of Egypt. Right? Why would anyone think you can get away? Remember, we discussed this. I'm not going to repeat it now. There's certainly a question on your midterm on this. That the Bible critics use this as a proof that Yerovam did not know about the Egel story in Shmos. There's no way the Egel story could have happened, and Yerovam does the same thing and sets up two calves with saying almost the same line, these are the gods, this represents the God who took you out of Egypt. Right? How do you counter such a claim? And Baal worship is okay? You know what I'm saying? You mean every time a Jew worships a Bozara, that's proof he didn't know the Torah? Every time a Jew violates Shabbos, that's proof that no one knew about Shabbos before that? Ever since our Sinai, Jews have been violating the Torah. Right? Following? If you want to prove from the Egel worship that they didn't know the Torah, and how did Baal worship get it slip in? Yes?
You're saying it was intentional?
This is the svar I gave when I mentioned it, is that it was meant to be a safety catch. Yerovam, I don't mean to explain things that in Sefer Shmos, Moshe is very angry and breaks the luchos over it. But Yerovam may have thought, there's no such pasuk in the Tanakh that says so, but I'm giving a svar. There are many people here, now that my kingdom does not encompass Yerushalayim, that are devolving into Baal worship. Let me give them something akin to Baal worship, calves, that at least will direct their prayer to the God who took us out of Egypt. Okay? Hello? There are two major movements that came out of Germany and Hungary in the 19th century that are still very popular in the world, right? The movements that called the Reform and Conservative movements, and the Conservative movements more of an invention in New York, in America, that was meant to be a safety latch for falling out altogether. Reform again, for falling into Christianity, and to Conservative falling into Reform. Right? So this is how we explain the second element, the Egel worship. The third is hardcore for the Zara, Baal. Right? So Shea doesn't talk about, when your problem is Baal, you're not going to talk about the small fry. No one's mentioning Bamos here. Right? Bamos is not the biggest problem. You following? Okay, when people might short say, Rabbi, why can't we do this, and this? I see in the 40s we used to... In the 40s we had problems with keeping kosher. I remember the rabbi of my short growing up in the Bronx, having to speak often about keeping Shabbos and keeping kosher. Right? We had a Hashkama Minyan packed with men who came at 6:30 in the morning. I used to go to this Hashkama Minyan. It's packed with men who went off to work afterwards. That's what Orthodoxy was in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Right? You're going to talk hardly anyone went to yeshiva in the shul. It was an Orthodox shul. It was a huge Hebrew school. Every kid in the shul went to the Hebrew school on Tuesday and Sunday. Right? Hardly anyone went to yeshiva. So you have to know which battles to fight, right? Okay, yes?
During this time, you're saying that they're avoiding the Baal worship, but by doing...
No, Baal worship is very heavy.
No, you're always trying to avoid it.
Oh, yes.
Right?
This is 200 years ago.
Right, but the point was that isn't that the same thing? Isn't that Bozara, another?
There's a Tosfos in the beginning of Bechorah that asks your question. It's Christianity, which is basically Egel worship, right? This man represents God. This calf represents God. You got me? Right? Is that a Bozara for a Ben Noach? So most Ashkenazi posts can say, no, it's not. he's directing his service to Hashem, to the Creator, let's call him that, right, and he's doing it through something else, a shituf, an intermediary, right? So to a Ben Yisrael, that's a bozara. Right? There were real nafkaminas lahalocha. Should you give up your life rather than give into Christianity or not? Right? One of the three. So everyone get this? Everyone have this? So let's start to answer these questions now. What is in Parakut Bet Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet? We started to do this. I'm sorry we sidetracked last week. And we saw that Hosea spoke with great chutzpah about the relationship between Yaakov and Esav. Right? That Yaakov is already babeten okav es ochiv. Babeten okav es ochiv, which means in the womb, he already started to hold on to his heel. Right? He's aware, very much aware of how Yaakov was born. Right? Uba'onov sorot es elokim. And in his depressed state, Ono is like being an Onain, he was in a difficult state. He fought with God. This is Perikus Bet Pesikali. Yosar el Maloch, Bayuchol. And he fought with an angel, and he defeated him. This is, by the way, forget about Mefarshim. I have a person in Tanakh. I have a Novi. Who says that who Yaakov fought with was not a man? It says Vayavik Ish Imo, right? Is that just a man inspired to tell Yaakov, "I'm giving you a new name now"? Forget about it. Any perush is bottled to a Novi in Tanakh who says Yaakov actually fought with an angel of God, right? El Maloch. Although those who are committed to say it's just a man, it's Vayavik Ish Imo, say it. A Maloch is a. It's a messenger. Yishlach Yaakov Malachim El Esau. Although there Rashi says Malachim Mamash. How Yaakov gets to get angels at his disposal is interesting. But okay. Anyway, a Novi says he fought with an angel by Yuchol and he defeated him. Bocho by Yishanen Mo. The angel cried, "I beg of you, let me go. I can't. You're holding on to me. I gotta get out of here." Okay. So, God appeared to him in Beit El afterwards, and God spoke to him there. Right? What is this? Now, Hosea seems to go backwards. Because what parsha does this represent is Parshas Vayishlach, right? Hence, some Sephardic communities have this as Haftorah Vayishlach. Ashkenazim read from Obadiah. Then he talks about, he goes backwards. What did he do in this place? Right? Why was he in there? Why is he away from Canaan altogether? What made him leave Canaan? Tell me two reasons why he had to leave home. After all, when it came time to find a wife for Yitzchak, the woman was brought for him. Right? And they didn't even know that the guy who went up there didn't know where to go. He got out of his phone and God will send you a malach. He'll tell you what to do. Get to make up a deal, or camels and water, right? This time it should be a slam dunk. We already know where to go. We know the family. Right? Yaakov, your mother has a brother there with two daughters. Go the same way. Right? Ibn Ezra, by the way, answers this question. It's amazing. He says the reason why they couldn't send for a wife for Yaakov the way they sent for a wife for Yitzhak, anyone can think of an answer? Well, there are two answers. Ibn Ezra says, because what do you have to do when you send for a wife? You've got to impress her, right? No one's going to just leave the house. At least in this generation, they probably know about the family. We're cousins, right? My father, your mother, a brother and sister. All right. Cousins often marry, right? But when you want to get a girl to come to your place, you've got to leave lots of gifts for the family. These are called siblonos in the Gemara. You've got to impress them. Avram did that. He gave her all kinds of gifts. He says, more where that came from, if you come with me. Right? So this is why Ibn Ezra says this couldn't be done for Yitzchak. Anyone ever hear this? you're hearing it for the first time. What?
Yes, sir.
Yitzchak couldn't send for, you know, couldn't send a delegation. I don't know if Eliezer is still alive, but, you know, send a delegation up north. You know where to go now, right? And get, and say, one of your daughters, love him, let him give one home, one home. Right? Esav is already married some 20, 30 years already. Yaakov was waiting all this time, right? And was still deciding what's going to happen in Yitzchak. Because Yitzchak is the patriarch, everyone, all the other Avram's children fall away. Is Yitzchak going to be satisfied saying the same thing? I don't know. I wouldn't think he should. There's a drash. Be Yitzchak yikarei l'chazor. Hashem told Abraham, only in Yitzchak is your future. Be Yitzchak v'lo v'chol Yitzchak. Okay, that's a drash in the Gemara. In other words, not all of Yitzchak's kids. I don't know if Yitzchak darshaned that way yet. He wants both his sons to follow in his path. Right? I, God, said v'rav ya'avot so'ir to Rivka. First of all, I don't know if she ever told that to Yitzchak. You're all following with me, right? I think she did. God, when Rivka was pregnant, she said, God, why am I suffering so much with this pain? That's what Rashi makes up a whole thing, you know, so it's a two, means that the mom is struggling. And so they're fighting, they're kicking, and there's more. And she asked around, is this what pregnancy feels like? And said, no, we never hear, we never had that. So she goes up to ask God, okay, why is this happening to me? So Hashem says, Shnei goyim mibitneich, Shnei goyim mibitneich yikaredu, lomi amot v'rav yalob sahir. You have two nations inside you. They'll always be at each other's necks, but I'll tell you this, the younger one is going to prevail. That's a chiddush, because usually the older one. All right, Yitzchak's not the older one, right? So it's not a tremendous chiddush. I think she told this to Yitzchak. She ran to him right away to say, Yitzchak, I have news. Two! Not one, two! And that's why I'm going through all this suffering. Now, she must have told him that day. Did she share with him this unusual oracle that says the younger one is going to be greater? Right? I don't know. The Mephoshim's are at odds why God used such a nebulous terminology of V'rav Ya'avod Tzair. It should have been Abachor Ya'avod Tzair. And even then, it's an awkward form of the grammar. So the Dazakanim and the Balaturim say that really what he meant was, it was meant to be nebulous. He wanted to be a little discussion between parents over which son is doing what, right? So Rabbi Avot Sevier means something great will work its way to the younger one. What is that something great? I'll let the parents discuss that. So when it comes time to bless these kids, Yitzchak wants to give, listen to the words, Tala Shemayim, Shemane Aret, Rav Dugan Nesirosh, Yavdu Chamim, Yishtach Vul Chalamim, Hebeg Yivir Lachach, Yishtach Vul Lebenecha, Orech Orum, Berchach Baruch. He's giving those words to Yaakov, but he thinks he's giving them to Esav, right? Go with me, please, concentrate. Is there anything in those words which contradicts the original oracle of Barav Yavod Sa'ir? So most people say, yes. Yes. Rav Yavod Sa'ir wouldn't be, he's bowing to his brother, and he gets and Esav gets all these things. It comes to Das Kanan to say, no, I don't think there's a contradiction there. Rav Yavod Sa'ir making the Yitzchak as pure as he is, where his background is, where people said they, you know, he's Abraham's son. He says, listen, Esav, what's going on my table? Esav is out there. I want to give Esav the Gashmi kind of guy. I want to give him all the Gashmi things in the world. Tala Shemayim, Shemayim Horez, the Fat of the Earth, the Dew of the Heavens. I'm going to give him everything Gashmis. There's nothing Ruchnius in there. No reference to Israel. No reference to Abraham. No reference to anything God told me. Right? But when Yaakov runs away from home, now we give a second reason why you can't get a wife for Yaakov. Ibn Ezra says because they were broke. They had no money. They had no gifts to give them. And Bani rips this apart. They were broke. That's why Esau was so quick to sell his birthright. What difference does it make? Dad is poor. He's broke. What's he going to give me? Right? This is Ibn Ezra. It's amazing. Right? So he had no gifts to give. How can I bring home a girl if I don't have gifts? That's why what Ibn Ezra says, that's why when Yaakov met Rachel, what's the first thing he does? He cries, I have nothing to give you. How can I get you to fall in love with me at this time in history? I have nothing to give you. Right? Yes.
Because you deal with the Rashi that says that that he was robbed by Esau's son.
Yeah, that's why Rashi has to say that. That comes in and to answer that same question, but that's not something an Ezra is going to say. If it doesn't rely on the Rashi for this kind of thing, right? I'll tell you, Bachor Shor, a student of Rashi, or from the school of Rashi, says that he was in such a rush to leave home because Esav wants to kill him, right, that he left the knapsack with the money at home. And everyone asks, so why? Because in the story before, there were all kinds of gifts being given. Why did Jacob have to work? Why couldn't he just marry her and take her home? Yitzchak didn't have to do any work. Because the 7 years of work were in the gifts that were given. You got me, hear me? Yaakov has to work and stick around. Deeply embedded in all this, first let me finish off the Das of Canaan, is that when Yaakov does leave home, Yitzchak gives him a second bracha. At the end of the parsha, there's another bracha. Why does he have to give him a second bracha? You've got your bracha. You took away Esav's bracha. Why does he get a second bracha? What do you, come on, figure it out. Why does Yaakov get a second bracha when he leaves home? The second one was the one he was supposed to get. Alright, you took Esau's. But now, Yaakov, I want to give you the one you were supposed to get. Now listen to this bracha. V'yiten l'cha es birkas Abraham. L'cha ulazaracha itach. V'rishkecha es eretz migurecha. Asher nesana l'kim lacha. Hear it? I'm giving you the bracha of Abraham that God gave, vouchsafed with me to inherit this land. No one mentions a land, no reference to a land with Esav, with the bracha he thinks he's giving Esav. No reference to Abraham, no reference to the future. It's all about Tal Shemayim and Shemane Haaretz. Don't you see what Yitzchak was hoping for? I'm going to create a Yisachar Zvulun relationship between my two sons. They will both follow in my path. Esau will get the gashmias he deserves, Yaakov will get the ruchnias he deserves, and they'll both follow. Yaakov will inherit this land. Esau will live in Har Seir or someplace else. And they'll be part of my nation. But Rivka intrudes upon this. And she says, my naive husband, you don't see things the way I do. I see Esau in a different light than you. I am bas bisuel ha'arami, nipadan aram achos lavon ha'arami. I know the difference between these guys. And if Yaakov doesn't have the Gashmias bracha, right, then he will not be able to contend with the outside forces of the world who always want to take down Ruchnias. I would contend the way Ramban reads Sefer Bereishis and Hoshea, this now plugs into Hoshea, I've been telling you this all semester, that the way Ramban reads Sefer Bereishis, which is that the actions of the fathers serve as omens and symbols for the descendants, is that the reason why Jews do so well, wherever we go, we talked about this, Parshas Hazinu, the observance of Torah guarantees success, right? Right? Not just hashkafically. Physically, it guarantees success. Follow these rules. Stay with your family, build up your children, make sure they go to school, stick around, make sure they're doing their homework. Don't run after your own delights at the expense of the people you're in charge of, etc., etc. Follow the Torah, you will be successful. But the amazing success, well beyond our numbers, for goodness sakes, is because of one biblical character, and her name is Rivka. Because she exchanged those words from supposed to be Esav, and she gave it to Yaakov. Got it? She should have told Yitzi, I hear you want to give this bracha to Esav. Making a big mistake. God told me when I was pregnant, Barab Ya'avot Sa'ir. Why did she have to resort to subterfuge? Why couldn't she just take it, explain to Yitzchak? The answer is, they had this nafkamina, they had this difference of how to understand Barab Ya'avot Sa'ir. Then we have a time that's gone. God, why do you leave these oracles so nebulous? And God says, well, do I have to spell everything out for you? Right? Some rabbis in their sermons like to spell everything. I like to leave things a little, maybe you can interpret this way. That's some Medrash works. That's how Rashi works. That's why there are 300 interpretations to Rashi. That's why 70 interpretations to every pasuk. Hashem purposely used a nebulous term so that we could negotiate between all these different approaches. What does this have to do with Hosea? Hosea is looking at a nation drenched in Tal HaShamayim and Shmalei Haaretz. I know I'm on tape, but I go to some of these yeshivish weddings with 42-member orchestra. Okay, they're swimming in money. They want to spend, make a memorable wedding for their daughter. No one remembers that, except to say, to disparage it. Where is going in the immense waste? And it's been crazy. The conspicuous consumption. It's too much. This is not why Rivka got us Tal HaShamayim and Shmalei Haaretz. And Hosea had enough. He can't take it anymore. And he gets on these crates and he speaks in public against it. So why? Everyone see why Vayetze now? Because Vayetze is about Yaakov being forced to escape this. The reason why they can't send a wife down for Yaakov is that there are two reasons why he has to leave home. And you see the brilliance of Vayetze? Vayetze Yaakov Mibe'er Sheva. Vayelech Harana. Two parts of the pasuk, because there are two reasons why he has to leave home. And Rivka is so brilliant. She is so amazing. When she tells Yitzchak, who probably says, but it's not a pasuk, who probably says, wait a second, why should we send Yaakov? Let's just send for a wife to come down right for me. Right? He probably told her that, or she just preempted him, knowing that we can't do that. But she doesn't want to say why. She doesn't want to ever discuss what happened that unfortunate day where Yaakov had the amazing chutzpah and gumption. Where did he ever have this gumption to do such a thing? To make it look like he's Esau. Who told him to do that? Don't you think that night that Yitzchak and Rivka had a discussion about this? Rivka, you will never believe what Yaakov did today. She doesn't want to ever have this conversation because she does not want her husband to ever find out that she was behind it. Right? So when it comes time to say that Yaakov has to leave the house, what's the reason that Yaakov has to leave the house? Look how brilliant she is. This is an amazing chess game. Not only does she get to have Yaakov has to leave immediately. Not to find a wife. He could wait weeks for that. But why does he have to leave immediately? Because, come on. Because Esau wants to kill him. Right? So not only does she get the defensive move by getting Yaakov to leave the house immediately, something probably her husband has to command, right? But she even gets to go on the offensive by saying that Yaakov has to go up north to my family. Because if Yaakov marries one of those Hittite women like Esau did, right? Yeah, she gets to deflect the whole reason for leaving. In Lokeach it's Yaakov, Yishom Ibnos Cheis Ka'ela Loma Lichayim. Going back to the original story, Loma Ze Anochi, with a pregnancy. What do I have to live for if all my children marry Hittites? So Yitzchak, please, do me a favor. Command our son. Tell him to go up north. Now, immediately. How should he have? Now. Right? And she tells Yaakov, I'll call for you when he quiets down. Something she never does. 20 years later, she never calls for him. She dies first. She never saw Yaakov. Right? Or maybe her punishment for being part of this unfortunate event. Right? And this is an amazing, Bechor Shor is an amazing page. Yosef Bechor Shor, who's a little after Rashi. He says that when Yaakov finds out that Esav is coming to meet him with 400 men. In the end, Esav didn't want to kill Yaakov, and Rashi says he wanted, but Hashem didn't let him. Alright, but in the end, in the very least, Bechor Shor says that he wanted to show Yaakov that I could kill you. Right? I'm more magnanimous, not bearing a grudge, but I could kill you. Alright, but get back to the point. Is that when Yaakov confronts the fact that he's coming out to meet me with 400 men, right? It says in the pasuk, "Vayira vayetzer lo." Again, typical Rashi. Why do I need to soak him to describe his fear and his distress? His fear lest he be killed. Why is he distressed? The famous line that Goldemeyer said at the UN, I can forgive the Arabs for killing my boys, but I can't forgive them for making my boys kill. He's distressed because I may have to kill my brother and his men. You familiar with that? Comes before Shor to say, that's a drash. I'll tell you why Yaakov has two reasons to be afraid. One, for the situation at hand. Two, my mother told me that Esav said, as soon as my father dies, I'm going to kill my brother. Assuming he is still the great Mechabed of Va'im, Esav would never come to kill me if Yitzchak was still alive. What is the assumption he's making, therefore, that enemy gives him two reasons to be distressed? Not only the situation at hand, but if he is coming out with me with all these men, and I have to simultaneously prepare in case he wants to kill me without insulting him in case he doesn't want to kill me. Right? That's what Vayishlach is all about. But he has a second reason for being distressed. If he's coming out like this, what might that mean, based on what my mother told me? The father just died. Just now. He waited till now. Right? Okay. What does this have to do with the end of Hosea? Okay, I think enough is, because he talks about where the intense gashmius has taken you. Okay? But here's the other point. Where did Yaakov go to escape his brother's wrath? What's the nation called? No one in this room can say when Yaakov was sent to, by his mother to find a wife that you can't figure what nation he went to? Lavan Ha'arami, Arami Ovei Levi, went to Aram, okay? So this is how prophets worked then, the same way that rabbis in their sermons work now. He told them, we face a mortal threat from Aram to the north. We face even a worse threat from Ashur, further north. But you know what? We faced a mortal threat from Aram before. You ever hear in the Agada it says, Bikesh Lavan La'koras Hakol, right? I'm not saying that Yaakov knew the Haggadah, but it would appear, who could read this now? It would appear that what Hosea wants to do is to set up a situation where he wants to convince his listeners. He wants to convince his listeners that we will survive this threat just as we survived it in the past. Okay? We had a mortal threat to our existence in the very beginning of our history with Aram, and we survived, and we will survive again. That is what chapter 12 and 13 is. Okay? Now let's quickly go to chapter 14. By the way, in between, I told you that the end of Hosea is very difficult Hebrew. The concepts are easy enough to figure out how to work through the Hebrew, but they're given to very broadly different interpretation. But everyone agrees that the what he's telling, what will happen, is devastating. Devastating. And it all came true. Right? Within some years, everything was gone from the north. But some of the descriptions of what will happen along the way are horrifying. It says that the Syrians will rip out children from the womb of their very pregnant mothers. Which also gives lends some hint to Rivka's pregnancy, Yaakov and Esav and something, but that's not even as bad as it gets. But in these chapters, he tells them, chapter 12 and 13, that what terrible things the Assyrians are waiting to do. And I will allow two different positions to creep into our text, is that Hosea is still, even at this late moment, exhorting them, these things may not happen if you still can choose. Wow. Why do I say that? Because of how chapter 14 begins. Shuva Yisrael Ad Hashem. Yichashal Tevavonecha. That's where I would start. That's where the Torah starts. And again, why you have Perek Yudalef Pasuk Aleph still relating back to Gimel, I can't explain why Bishop Langton closed and divided the Prokem this way. The division of Prokem is done by a Christian. Right? In the Torah begins Perek Yudalef Pasuk Beis. So Shuvi Yisrael can mean, guys, you still have a chance to prevent all these terrible things from happening if you return to me. Right? Or it can be read in light of what like appears at the end of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu says, no. Everything I've said until now is certainly happening. These prokim are for you to return 70 years later. Okay. I don't know. Since from the time that Hosea's prophecies came true to our very day now as we stand here, these people have not returned physically. The 10 tribes have not returned. We don't know where they are. That's a shear unto itself, which we'll, like I said, when we do almost on that, we'll have more to say about it. Okay. So, okay. So this is how we read this. I think that the correct way is Shuvi Yisrael Ad Hashem Ki Chashal Tevavonecha. Right? As a reader of Bible, I want to say that there's always some kind of chance to turn back an evil decree. Right? We don't know what stage it's in. Yes, there is sometimes a stage where you can't turn back. But we don't know where it's at that stage. On Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we say, Tshuva Tefillah Tzedakah Ma'avirin Es Roa HaGezerah. It doesn't say, Tshuva Tefillah Tzedakah Ma'avirin Es HaGezerah. The Gezerah is passed already. But you can possibly Ma'avirin Es Roa HaGezerah. The bitterness, the evil. Alright, anyway, let's do Pasukim. Take words. I want words here. I don't want your Korbanos. Why would I say that this Pasuk is talking about Korbanos? Because the last three Pasukim of this Pasuk are three very famous Pasukim. Three very famous words that have to do with something we do on a regular basis. You hear? On the Shalma Parim, we will obligate us to pay our obligation to God of our cows with our lips. A very famous halacha that we derive from these three words, which is that today, in the absence of a sacrificial order and a place to offer sacrifices, we replace that sacrificial order with pray with our lips. We read this before. The Shalma Poritz Oseinu. Right? In the beginning of Brachas, in the fourth parak, the Gemara talks about Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov were Misakin Shabbos Mincha Maariv, but it's also connected to Midian. Right? So our lips can take the place of Korbanos. Right? The Chiddush of Hosea is that that's even true when the Beis HaMikdash stands. Right? We already had a discussion about the nature of Korbanos in the ancient world and what man thought they were doing when they were bringing the Korbanos, right? It's a great point here, right? That you can, with your lips, turn things around. What do you think the Gemara says if a man says to a woman, Hareyak mekudeshesli almanas she'ani tzadik? You are betrothed to me, here's a ring, some say even without a ring, and that the hanah that she gets for being married to a tzaddik is enough for a shorah gruta. But let's say, according to all opinions, she gives her a ring and makes the kedushin conditional on the fact that he is a tzaddik, or anything else. You can make the conditional on the fact that he is an oshir. Then we have to make a test afterwards. Does he give a satisfactory manifestation of being this thing upon which condition they were considered married? You got me? So what do you think? All right, Oshir, you have to make a test. And he can't answer Pirkei Avot's definition. Right? You know what I'm saying? Because she gets, wait a second, you told me you're an Oshir. Good, flat broke. Because you have at least on Samech Chalko. Right? Phone? Says, you told me you're a Gibor. Yeah, but I'm Kovacious Yitro. It's not Pirkei Avot's definition that determines whether these things are correct. It's her determination. Right? She has, and Usher is somewhat, Usher is somewhat subjective. Right? So the Gemara in Kiddushin discusses some objective definitions of Gibor, Usher, etc. But the Gemara insists that once a man says, Harei Mekudesh Esli Al Nashem Itzadeh, and she accepts the ring, there is no test. What do you think? Married or not?
Yes.
Married. As soon as you say Al Tzadeh, what are you talking Tzadeh? What about the five murders he committed yesterday? What about the money he stole 2 days ago? What about the Lashon Hara? He needs to ask forgiveness from people. As soon as a person says, I'm a tzaddik, I usually say, you know, say this right before your paper starts, just say you're a tzaddik, that's all you need. Now, let your next deed determine whether you're lying or not. But at least say, I'm not shiny tzaddik. All right? Let's start off that way. I may backtrack, I may backslide, okay, fine, but everyone does, we're all humans. But okay, so that's what he means, when the shaman proves for saying, just use your lips and say things. You don't have to bring kavanos. Yes.
If you're going by the second way that we said that you can interpret it as that saying that you can return after all this destruction happens already, so why can't be referring to after the faith of English is already destroyed, that you can then still continue praying with your lips?
Yeah. Although it's not a threat that Hoshea would make to the 10 tribes that the faith of English would be destroyed, but it could be still. The time will come where this sacrificial order that you find so important in Don and Beit El will no longer be there. Fret not. The main thing is even now. Pray. Talk to God. Right? Okay. So we see there's all over Perek Hey, Zion, Ches, Yudeh, Perek Aleph. Perek Aleph plus Zion, where he said, I'm going to save Yehuda. Right? From Ashur, but I'm not going to save you. But here he's saying, Ashur lo yoshienu al sus lo nekav, lo nomar o de lohidu lamaseyodenu, shabakoy yurucham yasam. Says that in all of your threats from Aram, from Ashur, where you're sending bribes to Ashur, you're sending bribes to Aram, and you're buying off this nation for that nation. What a mishmash. Well, who would have thought in 1943 Germany would be a good friend of the State of Israel in 10 years and Russia would be trying to kill all its Jews? Right? There was a plan in 1951 for all the Jews remaining in Russia to take a Siberia and kill them. It didn't materialize because Stalin died. On Purim, I might add. Okay? Anyway, so he's saying that in all, stop worrying about all these geopolitical facts and run around between Svivos, between Aram and Ashur. The only thing that will save you is your faith in God. Now, does that mean that that's what we should be saying today? No. Get out and vote. But I don't mean to say that because that was true in Hoshea's day, that it's true today. You follow what I'm saying? Okay? I'm sure that rabbis have said, well, Hoshea said, so it doesn't matter what happens with the world. Come on. And people may have been saying that in 1933 in Germany too. But it's nonsense. All right? We have to do our ishtablus. And in the end, say, okay, leiv melech biyad Hashem. Whatever the king ends up doing is in the hands of God anyway. But it's absurd to say that to rely on that alone because Hoshea says it here. All right. First of all, Hoshea is a prophet, and the last I saw, we haven't had too many prophets around in our time. Okay. He says, "Okay, erpomish basamo havein the devar, he shava pi mimenu. I'm going to heal all of their rebellion, even though havein the devar." Rashi says they love payouts. Everybody is getting shalom. Everybody's getting. They like to pull in the Dava, but it's all payouts. It's all corrupt. I have, my anger is ready to be waned against them if they return. I don't have the time here to elaborate on this, but this pasuk not only undoes previous threats of destruction. It does it linguistically. Remember Yahweh, Yahweh Sheinu, he's using words, he's such a brilliant... Remember this, there's a question on this also in the midterm, that Hoshea uses a lot of literary formulas He uses alliteration. He uses rhyme. He uses puns. He uses simile. He uses personifications. He's just he uses meter. It's just amazing what goes on in this book with wordplay. Right. So what's happening in Bob in Zion is that he's undoing previous predictions for the death and destructions, the death and destruction, and he even does so with linguistically. Right. This may be a projectionism. Assuming that these words are at the end of Hosea, he's projecting. He's saying, right now we're doing okay, but there will be times when the Assyrians come down where there will be mass starvation and famine. And then he's saying, and after that, I will return. I'll give the Dagon, I'll give the Tirosh. Remember in the beginning of the book, one of the problems is that we all felt that our corn, our oil, and our wine, and our wool, and everything we get, are we getting from various bottles, right? And he says, no, you're getting it all from the same source, from God. They're behaving like at the time of Abraham. Everyone went to the clouds, God for clouds, and he went to the rain God for rain, and he went to the sun God for sun. Look, another pun is coming up because it says, Ephraim, Mali Olga Sabim, Ephraim, what more do you have with your Atzavim, or Avodah Zarah? Ani Onisi V'Ashurenu. He's using the name Ashur for that if you answer me, or I, God, will answer you. V'Ashurenu means like Ashurei Ashurei Sefa. I can make you happy again. Yet he's using the word Ashurenu to describe their happiness. But that's the nation that's coming down here to take away your happiness. Right? I'll usher you. Right? I am like an evergreen tree. I'm always there. I never hide from you. Just have to define me if you know where to look. Right? And the Rosh Ranan especially grow in the north of Israel. Have you ever traveled in the Tel Dan? See those tall trees, hundreds of feet tall, really. Because there's so much water there. The trees keep growing and growing. Right? That's what he's referring to. Something they experience. Who's smart enough to explain Nahom Yigaim? Who's smart enough to know what's the path to take here? And in God's straight Yisharim, Sadikim will take it and listen to me. We're going to end the book. Ufoshim Yikashlubam. Because that's how the prophecy began. Back to the beginning of the chapter, it says, "Shuv Yisrael Hashem ki choshalta ba'avonecha." It's sort of a downer way to end. He says, "Listen, guys, I'll tell you this: if you think that this is, you listen to the prophet for the right path, you'll find it. But I think that the last three words are showing the futility of what Yerubim ben Nevat did." If you think you need to make a safety net towards me, right, by worshipping calf worship, or even bamos for that matter, yikashluba. There's no such thing as such a safety net. But you're over in the box, Edmund. That's what got you into this trouble in the first place. Egel worship is not a safety net against Baal. It's a gateway to Baal. Here, it's a very crucial way to end the book. Don't think you can divide, get back. Okay. I won't do Baal anymore. I'll do Eve. God is not my Baal. God is my Eve. Remember that Torah Parshas Bamidbar, right? The beginning of the Sefer. God, don't call me a Baal anymore. Now you're going to call me your Eve. Okay, no Baal, but at least let me have the Egel worship. No. That's just as much a pesha. I don't want that. Even if I am the object of the Egel worship. It's not a safety net. Remember this statement, right? I just coined it. It's not a safety net against Baal worship. It's a gateway to Baal worship. Right? And I say the same of what the Reform movement is. Church pews today are filled with those who may have meant well in Germany in the 1850s for what they reformed. Right? Okay? This is why you very rarely see like a third generation Reformed Jew. I'm not gloating here. Orthodoxy lost lots of Jews in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s also. But you very rarely see a third generation Reformed Jew who says, my grandfather was a Reformed Jew. Right? Third generation is Reformed Jew, their grandchildren are either Bali Tshuva or they're not Jewish at all anymore. 70 to 80% intermarriage rates in Reformed. It's 55% for all Jews in America. Orthodox aren't intermarrying so much. Right? So if you just take the Reformed Jews, it's 70% of the intermarriage. Right? But those rates after three generations, how many grandchildren are still Jewish? So he's saying, don't respond to me and say, okay, I won't do Baal anymore. I'm just going to do Eidol worship. I'll do Bamos. No. That's the end of the book. It's a harsh message at the end, but at least we understand it, okay? All right, so this is a Shabbos Tshuva message, because what does Tshuva do? Tshuva undoes it as if though it didn't happen. Okay? It's a big chiddush. The ancients did not believe in Tshuva. In most ancient cultures, they believed in courage to accept your fate. That you could change your predetermined fate is a big chiddush. Hosea is one of the first to publicly express it. Right? Of course, if it took him in the Torah, it was life. That's obvious, but that's where we are. Okay,